Okay, Dad. Hi, everybody. My name is Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And what a great talk, Maria. The Beatles used to have a song called I'm a Loser. I identified with that. My whole life, I thought I was Mexican. And, here's your notes. And I got sober, and I found out that I was an Anglo. A mean, nasty Anglo. But I'm glad to be here, and I want to thank the committee for inviting me out to be here again and taking another chance on me. I've got some friends here, and I imagine they should be here shortly. But I'm glad to be here. My wife was supposed to come out when Paul asked me to do this close to a year ago, and Rosie said that, oh, I'd love to go out. And she says there would be nothing that that I wouldn't do to come out there with you. You know, it'd have to be something major for me not to show up. My wife couldn't make it this weekend. They're having a garage sale. And her and her sister had to get there. So it's nothing like being number one on her list, getting that Christmas gift of used underwear. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for a little over 30 years and not amount to a damn thing, really. So if you're new, and I know we've got some new ones here, I've got news for you. I coming in last night, I got in here a little late, and I passed the off-ramp. I was supposed to get off at Date, and I went past, you know, Desert Hot Springs, you know, and it was kind of cool because you could see all the chimneys going and stuff like that. And I thought, hell, those are meth labs, you know. What the, you know. And I got in a little late, and, you know, I've got the type of head that the more tired I am, the more it wants to chat, right? I could be physically beat like I was last night, and around 2:30, that old head just, hey, I know you're in there. Let's chat. Let's talk about when you're a baby and bring you right up to date, for God's sakes, you know. And I'm there anyway, so, you know, and the frustrating part about that is we had just done that the night before, you know. It don't care, and... But anyway, late on the news last night after the Olympic highlights, they had discovered in Switzerland, if you're new, that they came out with a cure for alcoholism in Switzerland, and it comes in the form of a pill. So don't rush into this thing, you know. There's hope out there in the horizon, you know. And my first thought is, I wondered what two would do, you know. And... And can you crush them up, maybe, you know? you know? But it's good. We've had good meetings here, great meetings. Got to hear my friend Jim talk at the long-timers meeting, and then the Indian. And then the mean, nasty Indian, you know? So I'm glad to be here. I come from good folks. I when you're a loser like I was, it seems like when you grow up, people are always bringing people to your side to compare you to, you know. Why don't you try to be like Bobby, for God's sakes, you know? And I remember being a freshman in high school, and I got drunk on campus, so they marched me into the principal's office, and me and my dad are in the principal's office and getting ready to talk to the principal, and my dad notices this picture of the star quarterback up on the wall, and he says, you little jackass, why don't you try to be like Coy? Look at him, you know. You know, he's doing good, he's, you know, all that. And I said, all right, Pop, I'll try, you know. And so the next year I got drunk on campus and loaded on barbiturates, and I stole the janitor's cart and I drove it through the library doors, you know, and had to get that book back, right? And so me and my dad and my probation officer are sitting in the principal's office, you know, and my probation officer sees this picture of the star quarterback, and he says, why don't you try to be like Coy, for God's sakes? And I said, all right, I'll give it a shot. My junior year, my big sister starts dating some guy, and she brings him over, and who is it? It's old number 7 right there in the living room, you know. My mom comes running over in a moo-moo, why don't you try to be like Coy, for God's sakes, you know. My senior year, I'm in the Torrance jail getting ready to do 90 days, and the Daily Breeze comes, your newspaper comes sliding through there, and it says that Coy makes all pro CIF. And I go, God, I'd like to be like Coy. That guy's just moving right along, you know. And lo and behold, I'm about, 3 or 4 years sober in AA, and I'm in my plumbing truck, and I've got my cardboard rolled up because things are going good in my life, right, you know. And my sponsor used to tell me what goes around comes around, and I'm in my little plumbing truck in downtown L.A., and it seems like it's vogue in L.A. that on every street corner, some guy's selling oranges or peanuts, or he has this sign that says, I'll work for food, right? Like you don't, you know, and maybe you don't, you know, and I look like a guy that needs help. People are always telling me that Jesus and Jehovah and all these J guys are coming to town, you know, and I've got pamphlets and, you know, literature, you know, and I'm sitting at the stoplight, and this guy with the sign locks eyes with me, and he starts coming over to my van, and I go, shit, you know, I got $2 and he ain't getting it, you know, I'm a giver in AA, right, you know, and he comes walking over to the van, he looks at me, and he sticks his head in that van, and he goes, Larry Thomas. And I go, Coy, it's old number 7, you know. I just, my God, I thought you had it made, you know what I mean? And then it dawned on me that if there was any justice in AA, that maybe my sponsor or even Jim could maybe write this guy a letter saying, why can't you be like Larry, you know what I mean? And still waiting for that day, you know. But everybody's always seemed like they've had it made. Everybody seemed to be clicking right along and grasping and developing manners of living. And I'm dragging this anchor around, you know, wondering what I'm going to do and who I am, and just constantly self-obsessed. I come from good home. I come from good people. I was born in Detroit, in a little, my mom and dad put me in a little orphanage in California, and brought out to here when I was about 4 years old, and my mom's a little Scandinavian lady, and my mom loved diet pills. So my mom was always up doing stuff every hour of the night, you know. You can see her out in the garage around midnight sorting out nuts and bolts into the garage, or, you know, raking the neighbor's yard around 4 in the morning, you know, and she loved to eat that speed and make Afghans. So everything in the house had fresh Afghans on it, right? The chairs had Afghans, couches had Afghans. My dad's golf clubs had little poodle heads on them, you know. And if there was any animals, they had a fresh vest on running around, you know. And the house was small, and she had a little room, and you can hear her all night just going to town, you know. And she would eat that speed, and she had some hobbies. She had a lot of hobbies, you know. But her favorite hobby was to eat that speed and make these huge jigsaw puzzles, these 30 million piece jigsaw puzzles, you know, of Indio, you know. And she'd get excited about it. It's going to be a beige night tonight, honey, you know. And she'd run off to Savon's and get her prescription filled, and then buy her a carton of Raleigh cigarettes, because she saved the coupons on the back to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in. And she'd come home and put that stinky peroxide on her head and eat some more speed and start making these puzzles. And she had a big pair of toenail clippers, because if she got a piece that didn't fit, well, she snipped that son of a bitch right down, you know. Wedge that thing in there, you know. I had no idea as I laid eyes on my first tweaker, you know what I mean? But And no matter what time you got up, she was up. Just cleaning stuff with your toothbrush and, you know, just... And I loved being around my mom. I had no problem with my mom. And what was amazing is I would, you know, listening to this young lady talk about taking an inventory. What would be amazing to me when I would start on this fourth step, this fact-finding process. And we're dealing with the facts now, you know. My first sponsor, Don, used to tell me that the truth will set you free. Now, where is a lying, self-obsessed, delusional guy going to find the truth? That's what that book's all about. That book is the book of truth. That book will help you find that truth. And I remember writing that fourth step. And I remember seeing in this fact-finding process how much my mom loved me and how much these folks, and what I would begin to do with people who would love me. And it started with my mom. And it didn't start when I was 25. It started way back then when I was about 6 or 7. And it would follow me up until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and sometimes after. And that is what I would do with people who would give me love and attention and affection, and especially my mom. And you know what I would do? I would play her like a fiddle, that there would never be a time too inconvenient or an age too old for me not to put the touch on that dear lady. And I never want to forget it. I never want to forget what it's like to be a young man, maybe 17, 18 years old, and be put away in a place for a small period of time. I'm no big-time comp. I'm a punk kid. And I'm supposed to come home on a Monday, and I don't come home on a Monday. I come home on a Thursday, and I don't even show up at home. I show up at my mom's place of business. See, she's working in a dry cleaners and cleaning people's houses, and I'm ashamed of her. But I'm not too ashamed of her to show up at that parking lot at about 7 o'clock in the morning and stand in a parking lot with that rain hitting me, and I got my drunken mud on, and I'm about from here to those doors, and I'm staring at my mom in this laundry, and the only thought that I have is she better have a buck. And I walk through that rain with my disgust, and I go into that lady's place of business, and one more time I startle her with my presence, which would be an ongoing thing in that poor lady's life. And without batting an eye, I ask that lady for a buck or two. And she breaks open this Woolworth wallet, and the picture of me falls out when I'm 8 years old on a Little League team. The only decent picture she would ever have of me until I meet you. And without batting an eye, she gives me that $1 and $2, and I run off to Wilmington where I'm going to die. Now, the thing that brings it home to me tonight, with our new friends with us, is you take this same man, and you bring me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with my so-called desperation and willing to go to any length, and where every action that I take, my life depends on it. And I need to ask you this. How come when my life depends on it, if you were to put a secretary of a meeting as far as me and my mom in that parking lot, how come when my life depends on it, I can't walk that same distance and ask a secretary of a meeting for a job in that meeting that's going to save my life? But I can walk that distance and use my mom and people like her time and time and time and time again. And I'm here to share with you, if you're new, that it's been my experience, and that's all I got. That if my alcoholism doesn't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will, make no mistake about that. Which is why it's necessary for a man with a little over 30 years to still have a job in a home group. To still have a home group. To still have a job and a meeting on Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Not so that I can run off to conventions and tell everybody about it, but because of one reason and one reason only. I will never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. But I can get so drunk that I can't make it back. And I never want to forget what it's like to be running all through Southern California for about 8 or 9 years, looking in through your windows into your meetings, wondering if I'll ever be in the middle of this thing called AA. Will I ever be out here with you guys? And if I can find a thing, if I can work with my sponsor on this fact-finding process, if I can start identifying with you guys, if I can start finding some men to share with, if I can find out that thing that keeps me from serving you, I will have found a key to life. Because the moment I began to serve you, I couldn't keep it from bleeding in every area of my life. I couldn't keep it. And if I can find that thing that keeps me of being of service, I will have found the key to life. Now, I had no idea about that. Now, my dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. He's the kind of drunk that used to get drunk and sneak into his own damn house. It was an amazing thing, you know. And always through my bedroom window, which I think is a lost art in Alcoholics Anonymous, that old window climbing alky, man, you know. Nothing like sneaking into your own home, you know. It has to be your own home. Find out if it's your home, you know what I mean? And my dad used to love to get drunk and sing those old Nat King Cole and Bobby Darin and Bobby, you know, Frank Sinatra songs, man. And used to hear him, he'd start singing Mack the Knife, you know, and he'd get stuck on one phrase, you know. Oh, the shunk, babe, you know, and he'd just keep singing that, you know. And I want to go out and bump his head to skip him to a new, you know. And I was such a disappointment to him. My dad was the kind of guy who used to tell me, you don't know how good you got it. Back when I was your age, we really had it tough. Man, and he rang my bell. He knew back then I wasn't wrapped tight with gratitude. I've never been marshaled with gratitude. I've got to be beaten half to death today to be, you know, grateful for the good life I have. I'm selfish, self-centered, selfish little goof. I've got the ego as big as this whole room, you know. And I've got a 5-inch belt, a lazy ass, you know, where I don't want to do a thing. Right? I wake up, I think about a nap is what I do when I wake up, you know. drives my wife just nuts, man, you know. And what happens when you're that lazy and you got an ego that big is you wind up going up through life doing average things expecting standing ovations. You know? Go to work, you think that boss is up in that window going, Jesus Christ, look at that son of a bitch go, man. And, damn it, they don't make them like that anymore, you know. And, he only took a half-hour lunch. Where can we get more of those guys, you know what I mean? And I'm like that today. It wasn't too long ago I put a toilet seat on for my wife because, you know, I don't use it, right, you know? Put this nice, shiny maple seat there, you know? I was proud of it, you know, bolted that baby down and then waited for 3 months for her to say something about it. And she's a busy lady in AA. Night after night, we'd come home from her meetings, and I would go to bed, and she'd go to the restroom, and I'd just be sitting in there, and she'd come out, and she wouldn't say a thing. Just drove me nuts. I'm thinking, what are they teaching these women in AA? Just take, 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 you know? After the fourth month, it drove me nuts. She come waddling out of there one night, and I said, my God, I says, don't you know that's a brand new piece of wood you've been sitting on for 3 months? She goes, I know, and it's loose. You know, I said, well, it shouldn't be. I bought it at a swap meet, for God's sake, you know. And I was such a disappointment to the old man, you know, and, you know, he wanted me to be in the Navy and, you know, do all these things, man. And I tell you, I just couldn't cut it. There's nothing in me that says, let's do the good thing. You know what I mean? There's nothing in me that goes that way. And man, I don't know, around 11 years old, I got trying to be good and feel good and do good. And around 11 years old, there was four of us in a garage, and we started passing around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, it finally evened out that playing field, man. Whatever I lacked and whatever was missing, whatever doubts I had, and it shut off that god-awful head of mine, man. And for a couple hours, I was all right. I was right in the middle, baby, you know. And I loved it. I've never laughed so hard my entire life was that night, man. I never threw up so much. I was throwing up stuff, threw up stuff I ate when I was 9 months old, for God's sakes, man. And loud, you know. I kissed my first Latin woman that night, you know, and it was my aunt, but, you know, I just I counted it, for God's sakes, you know, you know, I didn't head out to Skid Row the next day and lose my paper out and come to AA, you know. But I made a mark of that night because that would be my reference point. And isn't it amazing? I would never find anything in sobriety that would take me to that safe place. And every time I drank, I stepped into the most beautiful little picture window where everything was great, man. I wasn't Betty and Bob's little boy. It was the safest place I knew, man. And the older I got, the more I drank. And by the time I got into high school, I started dating this little Mexican girl, and she introduced me to her brothers, and we used to lower our Chevrolets down to the ground. I had a 62 Chevy dropped right down to the ground, man. Had my hair up real big like a Bakersfield tumbleweed, right? Had my white T-shirts, black khaki pants that came up to here. Drive around drinking that Thunderbird wine, wondering what the hell you're staring at, you know? I had a girlfriend named Loopy. She curled her hair up real big, and we listened to the Four Tops and the Temptations and Smokey Robinson, and God, I loved it, man. I was in my plumbing truck the other day, and the Four Tops came on and just start sinking in my damn car, man. Women were telling me that men who are well endowed had big feet. I had a pair of 15-inch shoes. I was driving around it. I had my big hair, my big feet, driving around, you know, and somebody tripped over my foot tonight, and I felt proud, you know. Let me move that thing. It might take a while, you know. I loved it, man. I loved it. I remember one night we're drinking that 151 rum all day long, and Loopy says, "Let's drive to the Jack in the Box and talk to the puppet." I ran out of friends. I said, "Well," she goes, "yeah, come on, Weddle, let's go talk to the puppet, man." And I'm driving, and I'm drinking that one, and I see about eight puppets, really, you know, and I just try to hone in on one, you know, and I run the son of a bitch over, you know. Puppet's head's hanging over, you know, she's yelling at me. The cops come, they arrest me, they throw me on the hood of the car, they shatter my hair all over the place, right? I don't drive till I'm 30, big deal. There's nothing like riding shotgun. There's nothing like being on the passenger side of that car, drinking that wine, looking in that mirror, and discovering, God damn, are you a good-looking man. You know what I mean? You want to get an alky's attention, put a mirror in front of him, man. I swear to God, they've got a mirror in this elevator, and everybody comes off of it this way, facing the mirror, man. You know? Scared the hell out of me. That thing opened up. There's eight people in their backs are to me. And I loved it, man. I'm driving over there on shotgun. I look at myself in that mirror. My hair's all big and flat because I've been passed out on the window. All right. I got 13 pounds of tamale puke on my chest, you know. And I feel like dancing when I look like that. I don't know about you. I feel like dancing the salsa, you know. I remember one night we were drinking that stuff and went out to Shanghai Reds or Leonardo's or one thing, and I'm looking for my salsa queen, you know. I'm all fired up, you know. I got that rum on my breath. You got that JD's cologne on because I'm going to get it, you know what I mean? And you can hear the music a block away, man. It just gets your heart going, you know. Getting ready because here I come, you know. And pull into that place, man, and I'm fired up, and I see my salsa queen back by the bar. Her hair's all big. She's got flies stuck in her hair, you know what I mean? She's back there gnawing on a pickled pig feet, you know, and I like that about a woman, you know, and I go back there to make my move, right? I got these big damn feet. I feel like I'm skiing back there. I just, you know, but I'm cool. I got the big, and I roll up to her and I start talking to this gal for about 2 minutes, and her lesbian girlfriend comes over and starts beating the snot out of me, man, you know, just, and I want to get away, but my feet are so big they're caught between the rail and the bar, and she keeps nailing me, and I keep coming up, you know, and she, bam, like that, and that lady kicked my ass for 2 hours, you know, and I had no idea I was a victim of gay bashing that night, but she kicked the shit out of me, you know. I ran into a guy like that not too long, man. I'm over there at the Glendale Mall about 7, 8 years ago, whatever it was. And I'm going through the Glendale Mall, and this kid comes walking by me. He's got his mom's earrings on. He's got his earlobes are drilled out. He drilled out his earlobes, for God's sakes. Quarter size, you know. You can put rims in there, you know. Put an AA clock or something, you know. And he comes walking by me with all this crap in his ear, and he's got a ball bearing in his eye, he's got a ring in this eye, he got a ball bearing in his nose, he got a big ball bearing and a star on his tongue. He goes walking by me, he looks at me, and he goes, "Well, what the hell are you looking at?" I don't have a damn clue what I'm looking at, man, you know. I wanted to squirt him with some WD-40 to make sure he keeps moving on, man, you know. So we start laughing and talking, and now I sponsor the guy. Lives out there in Chula Vista. His name's Ron, you know. And when Ron was new, he used to call me up and he used to say, "Sponce, you know, I'm just checking in. What is it you want me to do?" And I says, "Well, why don't you unlock yourself, for God's sakes, you know?" He says, "Well, I go to these meetings and I feel so different." "Really?" I said, "Maybe you're the only one wrapped up in a chain link fence, Ronnie. How about that, you know?" And you know, when you start sponsoring these guys, they usually have your defects of character times 10, right? You know, to help you out in life, right? And sure enough, man, Ronnie was a lazy ass. Had a 10-inch belt of lazy ass wrapped around. Didn't want to do thing. Didn't want to do nothing. And I told him, I says, "You know what, kid? I says, if I'm going to sponsor you, you better get a job. Because the guys that I sponsor are self-supporting. We put money in that basket." I said, "So you better go out there and start looking for work or looking for a sponsor." That's when I was mean. And sure enough, man, this cat called me up about a month later, just so excited. You could just see his tail wagging, you know what I mean? And he, sponsor. And he says, I got me a job. And this kid was excited. And I love when there's excitement in the air, you know? And he says he got himself a part-time job. And I says, "That's great, Ronnie. I knew you could do it." I says, "What are you going to be doing?" He says, "Well, 2 to 3 times a week, I go to a sperm bank." I know, but he's excited. You got to be happy for him, you know what I mean? And now, I could just shoot back to watching that guy getting ready for work. You know what I mean? He's in the kitchen wrapping that celery up, right? Packing his lunch, you know. Throwing in his gloves. Grabbing that Hustler magazine. And going out to that hands-on job. I loved him. He's doing good now. But anyway, I just, you know, and I thought that me and Pooch and Loopy were going to bounce off for it. And every time I took a shot of that wine and whiskey, it worked. There was no doubt about it. And the problem with my life and the problem with some people in here is simply this. That the longer I drank, the smaller that window got. And the smaller that window got. And the smaller that window got. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was no big, pretty picture I was stepping into. That there was this dream. There was this thought, and there was this obsession. This time it's going to be different. I've got to find a way to keep this in my life if it's the last thing that I do. And I had no idea I was in the grips of a progressive illness. I had no idea that it had me. I don't have it. Had no idea what was going on with me. And in 1969, everybody's going places. A lot of folks are going to Vietnam, and I thought, well, maybe I'd grab my connection and go off to Detroit and find my roots. And I wound up in Phoenix. Over there off of North Central and Roosevelt at the Apache Hotel. It's about 5 floors high. Everybody has a TV. It's in the lobby. Everybody has a bathroom. It's down the hall. And you drink and you dream and you die. And you know, one of these days, it ain't going to be like that, man. And I start seeing guys drive by me in trucks. I see guys start driving by me in cars. And I see them with little lunch buckets and measuring tapes and tools. And I'm thinking, maybe that's it. Maybe that's what I need to do. Maybe I need to get a little normal job. And maybe if I got a little normal job, maybe my drinking wouldn't be so wild. And I begin to become obsessed with this idea that maybe normal living would help me not drink so wild and get into so much trouble. And isn't that amazing? To the untrained eye, it looks like that's what happens here. That people stop drinking and they come to Alcoholics Anonymous. They get a little room. They get a car. They get somebody to dance with, and to the untrained eye, it looks like the solution to this disease is normal living. And nothing could be further from the truth. You don't have to come here to get those things. That just takes hard work and good fortune. But I've been taught and I've experienced that the treatment to this malady that I have will be, it always will be, me, you, and the perpetuation of this gift. Me, you, and that book. I've got a primary purpose, and that is the only treatment that I have is in that book. And I had no idea what was going on with me. And I got over there in Phoenix, and I found this wagon wheel bar in a little hole that had no windows, just a dirty curtain blowing through there. Went in there, met a guy named Ernie. Ernie was from Tennessee. Ernie says, I know what we're going to do, kid. Come back in the morning, and I'll get a guy to put you to work. And I come back the next morning. He introduces to me this plumber, and the plumber takes me out to the desert and sticks me underneath a house. And he says, all I want you to do, kid, is hang copper. That's all I want you to do. And he gave me a little transistor radio. And I'm underneath this house. I got a PM bourbon bottle. I got a transistor radio. I'm underneath the house. I look over there, and there's a cat staring at me. You know, and I thought, my God, I'm on top of the world. I got it made under here, man. You know, I got a transistor, I got a pint, I got a pet, you know, and start drinking that hot bourbon under there, banging on that pipe every now and then to let them know I'm 9 hours later. They're dragging me out from underneath the house. Apparently, I got drunk and popped up through the lady's floor, robbed her of all of her jewelry. They're dragging me out. This cat comes running out with a bunch of necklaces on, you know. I get fired from that job. A couple days later, I go back down to the wagon wheel bar, and Ernie says, I know what we're going to do. I know what we're going to do. He says, not too far from here is a horse track. He says, we're going to get you down to 95 pounds. You're going to be a jockey. I thought, all right, I'll start working out, getting in the shape, and he had a little bag of speed. And I don't do speed. I just do heroin and drink and mind my own business, you know. And be damned if I'm going to be an Afghan maker, you know. No. He says, I just want you to take this stuff and take it for about 2 months and, you know, we'll get you down to 95 pounds and we'll go to the track and get our colors. And he was sure it was going to work. And he says, I'll come back in 2 months. And he left me with this stuff. And he took off. And 2 weeks later, he came back and I'm in that little room. I haven't moved an inch. I didn't, you know, I don't want to be, you know, I've been chasing a fly around my room, you know, and looking out at the window every 10 seconds through these little shades going, what's that? What's that? What's that? What's that? You know, and seeing these devastating black and white flashes. That's the damn sun going up and down, you know. He comes back. He says, you couldn't have possibly taken all that. I said, well, I did. And I'm all frightened. And you can put a saddle on me and ride my ass down the track, you know. And I'm 2 weeks of just chasing a fly around my room, and anything that's white, I'm trying to fire it up, you know. It could be a damn toenail. It's going up, man, you know. Worst 23 days of my life, man. So I went back down to the bar after that, and I hooked up with another plumber, and I started working for this guy for, I don't know, maybe 2 hours. And I found out that he was younger than me, and I ain't working for a kid. I got my pride. So I did what any, you know, honorable man would do. I faked a knee injury. Went down to the county hospital, you know, and they wrote me a prescription for Percodan. Yeah, the doctor wrote me a prescription for Percodan, and then he left me a box of blank pads to have. You know, I grabbed that box, go running down Central Avenue, you know. Ducked into the wagon wheel bar. I show Ernie what we have. We started drinking our bourbon, and he makes a phone call to some guys out in Gilbert, Arizona, and we start writing and selling prescriptions. We start writing prescriptions for Seconal and Nebutol and Tuinol. You name it all. We wrote it all, you know. Damn near took it all, too, you know. And after about 9 months, they caught up with me. Now, when you're loaded on whiskey and barbiturates, there's no freeway chase, you know. There he goes down the 10 freeway. Look at that son of a bitch go. None of that's happening. In fact, I was going 9 miles an hour, and the cop was walking by me. He was just... I'm in my car going, man, can that son of a bitch run, man, you know? So they arrested me and put me away in southern Arizona for a while. No big-time convict, punk kid, and A little while later, I came back to Los Angeles, California in 1974 and went to the Los Angeles City Hall, and they gave me a probation officer and they stuck me on antabuse and they gave me a voucher for a hotel in downtown Torrance, the Greyhound Hotel. Beautiful place. Everybody's got a TV. It's in the lobby. Everybody's got a bathroom. It's down the hall. And I'm still drinking and dreaming and dying. They got me on this antabuse, and for the first time since I'm 14, I ain't got anything in my system. And I get a little call from Volt or Manpower or some high-tech place like that, and they got a little janitor job for me at a refinery, and I take the bus to this refinery, and I'm about 2 hours, 3 hours early, and I'm in this Little League field with not a thing in my system, and I go absolutely out of my mind. In between hysterical and maniacal, my paranoia gets so tight that I begin to hallucinate and they stick, become somewhat catatonic. Somebody calls the paramedics. Paramedics come and get me. They take me to the Harbor General Hospital over in Carson, California. They look at some of my paperwork and my jacket and they say because of some of the things that have been going on in my life that maybe I need to go to a state hospital out by Oxnard to be observed for 30 or 60 days. And a year later, I get out. Totally observed at that point, you know. And they gave me certain medications to take, but I tell you one thing you can't medicate away is that idea that maybe this time it'll be different. You see, I'm an alcoholic. The memory of my last drunk doesn't seem to have sufficient force to keep me sober, no matter how nasty it is. See, I've got the disease that does not need my permission. I don't have a fear anymore of drinking. That was my biggest fear when I got here, was I was afraid I was going to drink again. I'm not afraid anymore. I know I will. I'm an alcoholic. Everything in me is faced that way. And I had no idea what was in store for me. And I ran out of Thorazine after several months. And in 1975, they find me over there at Alvaro Street, public nuisance, public drunk. They rolled me up on a violation and sent me up to Wayside. I'm up at Wayside, and after about 50 or 60 days up there, they put us all in a bus and sent us down to the South Bay Courthouse in 1975, where I'm going to be tried and convicted and sentenced to 2.5 years in the state pen. And I'm in a holding tank about this size. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, everybody's gone. All the buses are gone. All these other guys are gone. And I'm in this holding tank all by myself, sitting on a concrete floor with a Vons bag and no hope, wondering where they're going to send me now. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I hear some keys. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a Scottish man with a patch opened up a jail door. And he said, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "Aye, lad." He says, "Come with me, son. You're going to AA." And I thought, "My God, what's AA? And who's this Scottish pirate all of a sudden, you know? Is he real, you know?" And that man took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. And in my heart and in my soul, he's what they call a trusted servant. Now, what would make that man a trusted servant for me? Simply this: he had no business being there. And we've got a couple of them here tonight. He had no business being there. He wasn't a counselor. He wasn't a probation officer. He was a refinery worker who just got the worst news of his life. His little wife was suffering. And he had some things going on in his life. Somebody died. He knew she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. But somewhere in his home group, somewhere in his book study in Torrance, somewhere in his men's stag on Monday night in the desert, somewhere in his 12 and 12 in Long Beach, somewhere in his home group in his meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous, that man was to sit quietly with you folks and grasp and develop a manner of living that ingrained in him this. Practical experience tells us that nothing will ensure immunity from drinking than intensive work with other alcoholics, that this works when other activities failed, and that pierced his little head, and he turned his little car around, and he went to the South Bay Courthouse, and he talked to Judge Foy and Judge Hollingsworth, and they said, "I think we got a guy for you." And that man took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm ready for a long ride up north and maybe some lunch, right? He takes me for a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that car, he tells me the news. He said, "Son, I know you've had a tough life and you feel different. My God, I've been ringing that bell my entire life. I'm different." And he says, "Larry," he says, "I know you've had a tough life and you feel different." And he says, "I can't wait for you to meet these people. I can't wait for you to meet these people." And he says, "Son, don't worry about feeling different." He says, "The more different you feel, the more qualified you are." You know, nobody comes here happy and well-adjusted, man. You know what I mean? And that man took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, a 15-minute car ride. And he drives up to this dingy, stinky, rotten, smelly, pukey, filthy, dirty Alano club. I never seen that word before in my life, Alano, you know. Watch for crossing Alanos. What the hell is an Alano, you know? Is that like an elk or a moose or what, you know? And he rolled up to this club, and there they are. There's all the Alanos walking around, man. Everybody had a nickname and a tattoo. He introduced me to, you know, Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Santa Claus Ray, Dancing Pete and Whistling Bud and all these other people, you know, and little moose come walking across the show, running across the park, and, "Hi, honey, I'm expecting a miracle." And I said, "My God, I bet you are, you know. I'm not it, that's for damn sure, you know." And then this transvestite came out of the card room. He starts circling me like a helicopter in Norwalk, you know. After about three times around, he lands. He comes walking over to me in his new moo-moo, and he says, "Hi, I can't wait to take you to our candlelight meeting." Candlelight meeting? I says, "I don't think so, big guy, you know. Not till I get my year anyway, you know." I told Alex, I said, "My God, that guy's got big feet, you know." And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. 30 days and get drunk, and 60 days and get drunk, and 90 days and get drunk. And the longest I could stay sober was 6 months because I was on heroin. It seemed to take the edge off. And that was the biggest lie that I told myself, was that I was coming in and out of AA. I hadn't touched Alcoholics Anonymous. I did what I've been doing my entire life. And it came out in this fact-finding process. I did what I've been doing my entire life. I sat in a room waiting for people to do something for me. I've been sitting in rooms my entire life with my hand out, whether it be the state or the county, waiting for a block of cheese or check or something. I've had my hand out my entire life waiting for people to do something for me. And isn't it a miracle that what I was waiting to be done to me, God was waiting to do through me? If you're new, there's nothing to get here. There is nothing to get. Look around you. There's nothing to get here. Believe me, there's nothing to get here. Your getting days are over. You might receive a little bit every now and then, but the only thing you're going to get here if you're new is be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life, man, because this is the longest thing I've ever done against my will my entire life, man. But isn't it amazing? Isn't it amazing how I had this childish idea of what Alcoholics Anonymous, I expected so much from it, and I didn't want to do a thing. I'd been so used to people doing something for me. And isn't it amazing that the most spiritual thing you'll see happen to a guy is that the more he serves you, the clearer his God becomes. And the more he serves him, the darker he will become. There is a miracle here. There is a miracle here, and it's nothing that you can pray about, and it's nothing that you can wish about, but it's something you must take an action about. One of the biggest problems in institutions that cause all the fights is disrespect. One of the things that I had no part of is I had disrespect for me and everybody around me. And once I began to show respect for the folks that were saving my life, and it started with my home group. When I began to show respect for this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, instead of treating it like a step down, I began to treat it like a step up. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And every time I called central office, you'd come and get me. And there would be this Montana cowboy that would always come and get me, Don. Don would always come and get me. And in 1980, I'm at the Don Hotel in Wilmington. I'm up on about the third floor. It's about 10 o'clock in the morning. I've got a bourbon bottle cut in half. I'm watching Jeopardy so I could really feel like an idiot. You know, and every now and then I get one right. Donald Duck, all right, you know. 10 o'clock in the morning, Don comes over. Oh, my God. Larry, it's Don. Man, it's that guy from AA. And he didn't call him, and he's coming over here, you know. And he opens up the door, and he says, oh, my God. He said, you had 15 days. You had 15 days, kid. What happened to you? And I took a slug off of that bourbon bottle, and I told that guy, Don, I says, I don't want what you have. I don't want what you got. If I ever get that bad, I'll know what to do. Why don't you get the hell out of my room and let me do what I want to do? The cry of this alcoholic my entire life. And the moment that I said that, it shot me back to 1967 when my father's kicking me out of the house at 16 because I'm getting drunk and getting in trouble with those lowriders. And he says, you want to live that way, that's your business. But you ain't going to do it at my house. I've got a wife and two daughters. And the old man kicked me out of the house, and I went after him. He just had a kidney operation, so I made sure I hit it. And in that fact-finding process and this inventory, I remember my dad being on top of the list. You see, I had a baby brother that died at birth when I was 5, and I blamed my father. You promised me. I was saving up my baseball cards and oiling up my glove for 9 months. And you told me I was going to have a kid, brother, and I blamed my dad for that, something he was powerless over. And it started building this wall, and finally I was able to separate me and my dad, and I had enough hate at him. It shot me back to 1972, and I'm sneaking up on my mom again, my poor little mom. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I sneak up on her, and she's break into her little place, and she's watching TV, and I got my drunken mutt on one more time, and this grown man has got his head on his mom's lap. And my mom starts rocking, and she starts crying to this Michigan God, and I can feel her tears hit me on my cheek. And she starts praying to this Michigan God to please help her baby boy. And I said, Mom, don't you worry. Everything's going to be all right. It ain't going to be like this, Mom. One of these days I'm going to get me a job, and I'm going to straighten up. Don't worry. And she waddles off to bed. And then it dawned on me that my dad always had some bourbon underneath the disposal. And I went in there looking for the bourbon, and I couldn't find it. I started going through my mom's cupboards, and I couldn't find it. I started making enough noise for my mom to start coming out of that room, and she starts yelling at me, honey, what's wrong? What's wrong? And I start banging my mom around till I get blood out of her nose, demanding that she come up with a bottle for me to wake up the next morning to see that I'd already drank it, that the empty was in the trash. And all that went through my head is the only answer to life I've ever had left that room, that bald-headed carpenter. And from 1980 to 1982, I'm stuck with the memory of you. And I can't stay drunk, and I can't stay sober. And that's all I do. I stay sober as long as I can, and I stay drunk as long as I can. And the nightmare of my life is that I wouldn't die. And on May 2nd, 1982, I'm over at the Beacon Light Mission in downtown Wilmington. I go by the Woolworth window, and I lock eyes with the thing. And the thing's about 120 pounds, and he's yellow. He's got his hair down to his back, and I got everything that I own on my back, and I ain't drunk. And I lock eyes with this thing, and I said, my God, whatever happened to my dreams? And it dawned on me, I never had a dream that I'm an alcoholic, that the only thing that I ever think about is maybe this time it'll be different, that I'm an alcoholic. It seems like sobriety drives me to drink time and time and time again. Because I think that if I don't drink, everything will be all right. And I don't drink, and everything's not all right. And the longer I stay sober, the worse I feel. And coming to these meetings and watching your life flourish only makes me feel so damn different that I don't belong here. And I don't know what to do, but I lock eyes with the thing, and I do what I always do. I start panhandling some money. I get some money, and I call Alcoholics Anonymous. And who do I get? I get Don. I said, Don, this is Larry. I've just checked into the Beacon Light Mission. I says, I'm ready to come back to AA. Will you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, no. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. Why don't you get your rusty rear down here yourself? I'm tired of chasing after you. And he hung up. I said, my God, whatever happened to that AA love, you know? I said, I just heard it. And then I turned around that corner, and I went to this little alley, and I started crying. I started crying like I'd never cried before. because I'd never been this scared before. And I came to believe that moment. And I didn't come to believe in God then. I didn't come to believe in AA then. I came to believe in the hopelessness and the futility of my life at that moment. And I knew that I wasn't going to die, that I have to go on living that way again and again and again and again, and that I was powerless for this thing to keep from happening. That no matter how dirty and nasty my last drunk is, I knew I was going to get drunk again. I'm powerless not to have it. And I was like a tail on a kite. It was just a matter of the wind hitting me. And I got so afraid because everything in me didn't want to drink. And for about a year, I'd been doing that frightful drinking where everything in you wants to stop, and you're drinking and you're crying. You don't know what the hell is going on, but you can't shut off the nightmares and you can't shut off the head. And you think maybe this time it'll be different. And I called that man, and I was so afraid I was going to drink that I started walking 10 miles to my poopy pants and no hope, and I waddled into that. And every time I pass a liquor store, I'm thinking, I got to go in and take it. No, you're not going to. You're not going to, man. You got to go talk to Don. And I walked that 10 miles, and I came up to that little Alano club. I asked them where Don was, and they said he's back around the coffee bar. And I waddled up to that guy, and I asked him something I never asked a man in AA. I said, Don, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor? And that guy lit up like a chandelier for about 5 seconds and then lit into me for 20 minutes, man, you know. And I stood ready to do anything to lift that merciless obsession because I knew that just not drinking wouldn't be enough. And I did whatever that man told me to do. And I fell in love with him. I never trusted anybody. And I started following this cowboy around. And him and Alex would take me to meetings. And they got me into service. They didn't get me into prayer. They got me into action. They got me into making this inventory. They got me into making some amends to my mother and father. And there was nothing like making amends to my mom. It took more than an afternoon and a lunch. The lady was afraid to touch me, and rightfully so. But I kept seeing her and I kept visiting her. And right now, I'm a happily married man for about 16 years. But every week I cheat on my wife. I go date my mom. I stop fighting my mom. I sponsor guys who are 60 years old and they fight with their mom. I says, my God, what can you possibly be fighting with her about? I says, if it gets too bad, come get me. We can take her down. I started letting her have her way, that whatever she talked about, I agreed with. Whatever she wanted, I started having fun with my mom. And my mom's got a great sense of humor. My mom's a beautiful lady. I see my mom all the time. She lives in this 6th-floor place with all these other moms, you know? And they all got balconies, you know, and on every balcony, they all got real flowers. And I'm over there visiting my mom not too long ago, and I realized that she don't have real flowers. She's got plastic flowers on her balcony. And I thought, Larry, you chump. And it dawned on me. I said, Mom, I said, all these other gals got real flowers. I said, let me buy you some real flowers for your balcony. No, honey, I don't want them. No, you don't understand, Mom. I'm going to buy them, and I'm going to plant them, and I'll take care of them. And you'll have real roses. And she goes, no, honey, I don't want them. I said, no, you don't understand. I said, I'm going to take care of them, and I'll come over. She goes, Larry. She goes, I don't want any real roses. I love my plastic flowers. I sit here every morning, and I get to watch the hummingbirds suffer. My mom don't got to worry about me no more. That peace of mind that Bill talks about in our book, my mom has that. I wanted my mom to have peace of mind. She's worried enough about me. I don't ever want her to worry about me anymore. I don't ever want her to worry where her son is anymore. I want everything I could possibly do to let that lady have a peaceful day. And to do whatever it takes to make that. I'm not a service to my mom. You brought her son back. And I respected everything that lady did. And I made amends to my father, and I began to become best friends with the man that I hated all my life. And at 5 years sober, I'm making these amends to my father. And we'd every Thursday night, we would have chili. And I would go to him with my father, and my sponsor told me, why don't you just start treating him like you treat me? Why don't you just talk about things that interest him? And I started on this relationship with my dad. And after about 8 years, my dad called me up one day, and he says, you know, you've been going to that AA for some time now. He says, every morning I get up, I tell myself I don't want to drink, that I'm not going to do it today. And I put my feet on the bed, and I put my feet on the floor, and I say, today's the day I can't go through this anymore. I'm not going to drink. And he says, son, by 10 o'clock, I'm in my glove box drinking my vodka. He says, you've been going to that AA thing for some time now. He says, would you come over and tell me about it? And I brought him a book and a directory, and I gave them to you. And me and my dad had a conversation on one of those chilly days. And we started talking, and we started locking eyes, and we started talking about amends. He says, son, I need you to know something. The hardest part, one of the toughest parts of my life, was the day that I had to tell you that your baby brother died. He says, because I watched you save your cards. I watched you oil your glove. And he says, I never seen you so excited about anything ever. He says, I didn't want to tell you, son. I was sad too. And isn't that amazing? How if you rightly relate yourself to this higher power, that you don't have to blame him for things that happen anymore either. We're always blaming him for stuff. I've come to believe that the God of my very understanding, when somebody passes in my life, I believe the old boy is just as sad as I am. And me and my dad started becoming friends. And my dad passed away, but you let me take care of him. My dad got that cancer in his liver. And my dad's only request from me, son, is he says, don't let him take me away. Let me die in my own home, son. And I says, all right, Pop. And my dad loved the Navy. He loved the Navy, and he loved showing me and Rosie all of his medals, and I used to go over there and write his checks and take care of him and make sure that when the hospice people came up, I could get him up and stand, because if he could stand, they can't take him away. And the last time he did that, he had a little Dodger hat on, and we stood him up, and he was smoking. And the lady from hospice says, Mr. Thomas, you can't smoke. And he said, ma'am, he says, what do you think it's going to do, kill me? One Thursday night, I went over there to write my dad his checks for his electric and phone, and I went into the bedroom he'd passed. He would lay in there, and I kissed him on the forehead. At the end of every meeting, I grab a man's hand like I will tonight. At the end of every home group, at the end of every meeting, I grab two men's hands. Several times a year, I give some guys cakes, and we hug, and we shake hands. Once a year, my sponsor gives me a cake, and he kisses me and says, I love you, son. You know that when it became time to show my father affection, I could do it, and I didn't feel weird about it, because it started here. Everything I know about respect for people starts in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor, Johnny, tells me that it's God's great blessing to give you his kingdom, and the kingdom is right here for a guy like me. The great search is over. The great search is over for folks like me. Some guy was asking me about the third step prayer and about praying and my opinion of God. And what I said, you know what? I said, I'm kind of a struggler for God. I don't have him pegged. But I know this. I know this from where I stand tonight. I would rather have my doubts and my fears and my questions about God and serve you than to pretend that I know everything about God and not lift a finger. Because there's so many folks around here who are like flying fish. Every couple times a year, they shoot up and let you know they're still here. Then they dive back down and you can't see them anymore. I am not concerned about what my God looks like. I'm concerned about doing his work. I'm concerned about what needs to be done here. In 1935, a butt doctor and a stockbroker got together. And Dr. Bob told Ann, "I don't want to talk to any more about my drinking, no more. I am so tired of talking, but because this is a friend of yours, Ann's, I'll give him 15 minutes. And Bill came over, and you guys all know the story. They went to the Cyberling guest house, and 4 hours later, they came out of there. And they had a moment. They had a moment. And Bob came out of there, and he says, "My God, this guy understands me. He understands me. He identified the magical thing of Alcoholics Anonymous." They had a moment, and that's why we're here tonight. We're not here for a raffle. We're not here for a dance, and that's why our meetings and our home groups are gathered up every Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, whatever they are, is so that maybe we can create an atmosphere for some little plumber to have a moment, for somebody to have a moment. This thing isn't mine to hoard and go home with. When the ass falls off, I come back. I believe Bill had it right on the head when he was sitting in Towns Hospital and his little childhood friend came in there and he started going over these proposals, and Bill had that blinding flash and the wind through the window. And I used to think for years that that was the spiritual experience, is that's what I need to do, is I need to have that. And little did I know that the answer was two paragraphs down. He knew he had to work with other drunks. That is the spiritual experience that has happened to me. Not a blinding flash, is that I've been inspired to help you. Nothing's been removed. If you know me, I've got every defect of character, you know. They're just riding shotgun. I just try not to let them have the wheel, you know what I mean? But what's happened to a guy like me is you've took a crazy, intense, selfish, self-centered individual, suicidal in every way, and you took these same defects of character and you've turned them around and you told me how to direct them, where I've got an enthusiasm for life. I've got an enthusiasm for a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a purposeful life. I am no longer useless. There's nothing more disgraceful than a useless man, and that's what I was before I came. You gave me a primary purpose and a usefulness. And that primary purpose is for me to carry this message, not from here, down there in my home group. Down there in my home group where I found my loving God. Down there with the drunks. Down there recreating an atmosphere by taking care of a coffee pot and making these meetings so comfortable that maybe all the newcomer, and that's why we have commitments in my home group. So when that newcomer comes there, there's nothing for him to do. The chairs are up, the literatures are up, the coffee's made. All that new guy has to do is sit in that meeting and hopefully identify and listen to the sweet voice of a loving God that's expressed himself in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and maybe have a moment. And maybe have a moment like you guys showed me, man. And if I can just recreate that, I'm a blessed man. I'm a very blessed man. And I've had wives and I've had a daughter. I love my daughter, Lauren. And after our divorce, my daughter Lauren, her and her mom moved to Phoenix. And for year after year, I would drive from L.A. to Phoenix to see that little girl, because the women in Alcoholics Anonymous told me, "You may not be somebody's husband, but you'll always be somebody's father. Don't you ever let that little girl wonder where you're at, Larry. If you can fly to Ohio and talk, you can drive to Phoenix and see your daughter." And my sponsor made sure that I beat that trail several times a year to go see that little girl. And every time I took that drive, I would tell myself, "What kind of loser dad are you? What kind of little girl would have a dad that has to drive to see her?" And I would show up with that little girl, and I would take her to daddy and daughter dinners. And I would write her postcards every month. And I would take her to those places where she could paint her own coffee cups and ashtrays. And on the way back, I would just, "I'm so glad I'm," and I do this year after year after year. Well, the last time I went and seen my daughter, she's 23 years old. And sure enough, on the way back, I'm beating myself to death. And me and my daughter have this little dinner, and my daughter Lauren looks at me and she says, "Daddy, I need to talk to you." I says, "What is it, honey?" She says, "There's a man in my life." I says, "Really?" She says, "Yeah, but there's a glitch." And I said, "That's great. I love glitches." She says, "He's been divorced." And he is divorced. And he's got a He's got two baby girls, 1 6 and 1 7. And last night he was over and he was crying. And I said, well, what was he crying about, honey? He says, well, he's afraid that because of the divorce, his girls are going to forget him. I said, what'd you tell him? She said, Daddy, it wasn't hard at all. I told him to send him a postcard every month. Take him and have daughter and daddy dates. And take him to those places where she can paint her own coffee cups and ashtrays. She said, John, if you do that, I know for a fact they will never forget you. That little girl saved every card that I made. This last visit that I made, she told me, you know, I met that guy. His name's John. And he's sitting across from me, and he had his mom's earrings on. Had a ball bearing in his eye. He's got a tattoo around his neck, you know. He says, what are you staring at? And I love the kid. I said, John, I says, what do you want to be? And he says, I want to be a rapper. I says, all right. I says, here's one. Put your hand in the air like you don't, you know, like you just don't care, and get yourself a real career, you know. And the kid's great. He's a good man. I'm a blessed man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I sponsor some guys that I truly love to be around with. My lovely wife I met here in Alcoholics Anonymous 16 years ago, my little Rosie. I talked at a meeting in Downey, and I met Rosie. And I locked eyes with this Nicaraguan. And all through the talk, I couldn't keep my eyes off her. And at the end of the meeting, I followed her out to her car like a little terrier in heat, you know. And she's trying to get into her car, and I'm still talking to her. And then she looked at me, and she says, do you like the backpack? I says, I love it. I never backpacked a day in my life, man, but I figured, what the anything to get into the tent, you know. Let me tell you, I love that lady, and I know she loves me because she became the first woman that I told other ladies about. And the men in Alcoholics Anonymous told me to treat her with common courtesy. That if you can have respect for a meeting and a sponsor, you can have respect for a lady. You don't need to yell at them. You don't need to do all that. And the more I respect her, the better I feel. And I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be that guy to her anymore. I want to be that guy that maybe she'll brag about. I don't want her to regret any moment with me. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the blessings that I've received, my greatest blessing is you. I never want to forget who had me when no one else will. Now, I've been running long, and I need to tell you this, that I don't know much about God. But I know this, that on a Saturday night out in the desert, I see row after row after row of people who should be locked up dead or insane. And look at us tonight. Look at us tonight. Look at us all weekend. We're happy and we're joyous and we're free. I don't have to know where God looks like. I don't have to know what he sounds like. All I know is that I get to come back and play in the evidence one more day. And thank you for this weekend.